Earlier this month, the fourth summit of the Americas came to Argentina. Heads of state from all nations in the Americas except Cuba met for talks on trade liberalization. Meanwhile, activists, students, and NGOs from all over the Americas, including Cuba, also came to Argentina. The third People's Summit of the Americas was a forum for grassroots alternatives to global capitalism. Steve Stewart is the International Secretary for the IDEA Network. It's an international coalition that works to defend public education from neoliberal policies. He was at the People's Summit, and he joins us in the studio to say more about what the People's Summit means for the ongoing campaign against economic globalization. Hello, Steve.
Hello.
Before we talk about the recent summit in Argentina, remind us what happened in the last summit of the Americas in Quebec City.
Well, the last summit took place in April of 2001, and I think particularly in Canadians' minds, the image that's left are the 3 days of street battles that took place. It was sort of a classic summit that was similar to the WTO in Seattle and Cancun after that, in that you had the heads of state sort of behind a wall, protected by thousands and thousands of heavily armed riot police. You had a kind of people summit where people from different sectors from all over the continent debated policies. And you had one large march of the more kind of institutionalized left that kind of marched away from the wall. And you had maybe 15,000-20,000 protesters from the more radical left, along with, although people always say the unions weren't there, there were quite a number of unions also participating in the protests attempting to bring down the wall. So you had sort of two and a half solitudes, to use our Governor General's terms. You had the heads of state inside, you had the protesters trying to take down the wall, and then the sort of quieter, friendlier protesters on the outside. What I found for Latin Americans was the eye-opener there was they never believed that in Canada you would see such levels of repression and also such levels of resistance from the population.
Had the talks in Quebec succeeded, what would the FTAA involve?
The agreement in Quebec was to bring about the Free Trade Agreement of the Americas, to have a signed agreement by January 1st, 2005, and that it would enter into force in December of 2005. And the FTAA basically would extend the North American Free Trade Agreement, although with extra restrictions, to the entire continent from Alaska down to Argentina. The critics say that it would basically lock in forever the neoliberal policies that have been sort of forced onto the Latin American countries over the last two decades.
How was the opposition different this time in Argentina than it was in Quebec City?
I think there were two key differences. On the surface, things seemed the same in that you had a big wall. You had heads of state meeting inside the big wall. You had, again, a more institutionalized left holding a very large march of about 60,000 people through the streets of Mar del Plata, a small sort of beach city. And you had, following that big march, perhaps 10,000 more radical protesters challenging the wall and facing tear gas. So on the surface, it seemed very much the same. I think the key difference was that this time the opposition was both inside and outside the official summit. We had in the march at the rally, at the end of the march, we had Hugo Chavez, president of Venezuela, address the crowd and receive the declaration of the People's Summit, which he agreed to take to the official summit and read inside. At the same time, actually, this summit was only possible because the heads of states agreed not to talk about the FTAA. Between 2001 and 2005, there's been major sort of shifts in the sort of positions of the governments, particularly in South America, and it was not on the agenda at all. Canada, Mexico, and the U.S. tried to force it on, and the government of Argentina refused to allow it to be put onto the agenda. And this led to very undiplomatic language between those five nations in the south in South America, make up most of South America, and those who back the U.S.-Canada-Mexican initiative.
How has the recent economic collapse in Argentina changed the face of opposition to globalization?
Well, that was one of the interesting parts. In 2001, when they decided to hold the fourth summit of the Americas in Argentina, Argentina was under a government that was staying loyal to the neoliberal diktats of the IMF and the World Bank. Within 10 months of that agreement, that government was brought down by street protests. They went through a succession of five presidents, an interim government, and finally an election where they were kind of surprised by a sort of candidate that took a centrist position in the elections and then moved to the left. And so that's one of the reasons there's been such a long delay in holding the America Summit, is they're trying to find a way around having it in Argentina, and also trying to find to have made some progress in the FTA negotiations before holding it. They were unable to, and they held the conference anyway. The collapse of the government in 2001 was brought about by basically bleeding the country to death. For a decade, it had been following to the letter the dictates of the IMF in privatizing everything, having a peso parity to the dollar, and all sorts of economic policies that basically brought poverty rates in the country from 20% to 50% of the population. And I think as a result of that, Argentines seem much more aware than in most countries of the direct connection between international trade agreements and international bodies.
Well, because that kind of thing happens in lots of different countries, but people don't make that connection.
Yeah, I think in many other countries, people blame their governments.
Right.
And the governments have a role in it. But unless they're willing to make a clear break with the sort of established order, they're kind of trapped into following the dictates of the, because they're indebted countries, and that's one of the reasons to keep the debt going, even when countries know that it can't, or when the creditors know it can't be paid back, because it means they can control the internal policies of those countries. In Argentina, they went too far, basically, and it brought about a collapse. All sorts of experiments and alternative economics happened. People learned that you could lose the neoliberal economy and still create your own economy. That economy is a fact, no matter what happens. And they, I think, to an extent, lost their fear of the international lending organizations. But they also made the connection much more strongly. So in early November in Buenos Aires, you couldn't walk 2 or 3 meters without seeing anti-Bush, anti-FTA posters, massive posters all over, some put up by the municipality. The best graffiti I saw there was, Bush, get off the planet. main sort of center-left labor central declared a general strike on the day that George Bush arrived, and it was fairly well adhered to, so the entire, about half the population of the country went off the job on the day that that Bush arrived. So you saw a real sense of connection, and this, I think, buoyed the Argentine president to take a very strong stand despite the intense pressure.
What was the official theme, I guess, of the Leaders Summit was creating jobs to fight poverty and strengthen democratic governance. What did the leaders actually talk about?
In general, it seemed, at least from the press reports, because again, I wasn't inside the official summit, but most of their time was spent fighting on whether or not the FTA should be back on the agenda or not. There was some talk, again, Hugo Chavez presented a proposal. He sort of came into the summit with some strength because the week before, UNESCO had declared Venezuela free of illiteracy, becoming only the second country in the Americas after Cuba to achieve this. And he put forward a proposal on combating poverty of a sort of Americas-wide initiative to end poverty in the Americas, and committed $10 billion a year from Venezuela towards this. The other countries didn't seem to take this up. And again, most of the focus was trying to get a kind of declaration that everyone could agree on. And in the end, they couldn't agree on it, and they put the two positions in the declaration, one calling for reestablishing of the FTA talks and the other saying that the FTA was harmful to the peoples of the Americas.
Now, since the last summit of the Americas, five South American nations have formed a trading bloc outside of the FTAA. How is trade between these countries organized differently than it would have been under the FTAA?
Well, I think the key difference there is that you don't have one large power sort of imposing. The fear that most critics of the FTA have is that once it's signed, Canada and the U.S. will dominate the trade and export services and manufactured items in return for low-price basic products. What's happened in South America is you have a dangerous combination from the point of view of the North, in that you have Venezuela, which is very rich in natural resources. You have Argentina and Brazil, which are very powerful in manufactured items, forming a bloc in which they can exchange oil for manufactured products. Cuba joining in trading services such as doctors and educators in return for and medical equipment, medicines in return for oil. And so they sort of, they don't meet all their needs, but they meet a lot of the needs that the North had hoped to be able to provide. You have also seen Venezuela entering into agreements with a number of countries outside that bloc in providing oil at rather than exporting it directly to the U.S., because Venezuela used to depend on the U.S. to buy their oil. But they're selling it at a 60% discount using ships built in Argentina to ship the oil rather than the transnational oil company ships. And so, for example, when the President of the Dominican Republic spoke in favor of Paul Martin's push for the FTAA, Hugo Chavez sort of looked him in the eye and said, you know, do you really support this guy's position? And the president sort of didn't say much after that, because there's economic clout there. It's not just like Cuba always had kind of the moral clout, but basically we're seeing the movement to a bipolar America. Well, the U.S. and Canada still form a much more powerful pole. Countries have the option of moving out of that orbit and still meeting their basic trading needs.
Now, some of the issues discussed at the People's Summit don't necessarily come to mind in the context of international trade. For example, you were involved in the Education Forum. Why would how would trade liberalization affect education?
One of the big pushes, both in the World Trade Organization and in any other trade agreement that the Canada and the U.S. enter into, is the liberalization, at least they use the word liberalization, of services.
One of those weasel words.
Yes, meaning that, like, in a way, trading of goods is less important to them than services. The U.S. and Canada both have trade deficits in terms of trading of goods, but in services they have a surplus. And they have the sort of high education, high technology that enables them to provide services at a lower cost. In the case of education, the goal is to be able to start, particularly through distance education, private schools, private universities in those countries, and sort of sell them at a buck. The education industry is a $2 trillion a year industry worldwide. So there's a lot of, sort of one of the last frontiers you can wrest from government control and make a buck off of. Where it becomes dangerous is when you combine it with a lot of the sort of neoliberal policies in education that have been pushed by the World Bank in return for loans. And one of the chief ones of that is increase in standardized testing. We see it here in BC. We see it all over the Americas. And standardized testing tends to be sort of multiple choice forms that with a good computer program you can mass mark, mass produce. In the U.S. they're already producing some Spanish language ones for their Spanish populations. As soon as under a trade agreement, as soon as you contract out things such as testing to private enterprise, you have to offer it to any of the countries within the sphere of that trade agreement. So when you see, like in Mexico and many other countries where they have privatized the testing of public schools, you see them become open for being bought out by U.S. companies that can reproduce the test for Mexico, Colombia, Ecuador over and over again, and so offer it at a much cheaper price than national countries. or companies. When that happens, basically a country loses its sovereignty over its education system, because it doesn't matter what's in the curriculum, it's what's on the test that teachers have to teach to. It's in multinationals' interest to take out the national element so that they can resell the test over and over again. And so you've sort of the combination of these neoliberal policies with free trade agreements, you lock in a system where countries lose control over their public education systems.
So the forum was useful then, because you could all get together and talk about...
Yes. I mean, we talked about strategies for defending, where there's been successful things for pushing back some of these measures. Standardized testing was a major issue that was discussed, as well as distance education and how to move that distance education where it is useful and to the service and control of the people rather than the corporations.
Well, thank you very much for coming in this morning, Steve.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with Steve Stewart. He works with the IDEA Network, and he was at the recent People's Summit in Playa del Mar, Argentina.